91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. First this afternoon is an update about South Florida's Biscayne National Park. We'll speak with its superintendent, Brian Carlstrom. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Biscayne National Park was created in 1968. It's the only water-based property of the National Park Service. 95% of its area is submerged, and it's renowned for its coral reef ecosystem. After years of study, proposals, and public input, there's a new management plan, which includes the creation of a 10,000-acre no-f fish zone. More of that in a bit. Linda Gastenheimer's Food and Dining follows. She'll tell about the Share Our Strength, No Kid Hungry Taste of the Nation event. We'll have Chef Adrian Kettlevo aboard for all the details. That's next, right after the news. And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, Thursday edition. This is sort of like our Friday, Bonnie.
Yes, it is.
It's nice.
It's been a good week, though.
Yes, it has. We've had some great programs.
We have.
Some excellent guests, and we shall continue.
It continues today. This hour has two parts. First, an interview concerning Biscayne National Park in South Miami-Dade, followed by Linda Gastenheimer's Food and Dining.
Biscayne National Park is a gem in our region. Nearly all of it composed of beautiful bay water. It's the northernmost section of the Florida Coral Barrier Reef, one of the largest in the world.
With us now is Biscayne Park's Superintendent, Brian Carlstrom. We'll discuss the park's new management plan and more. Welcome to you, Brian.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Good to have you back.
Great
to
be here.
And we have the park's Chief of Resource Management, Elsa Alvear. Thanks for being here, Elsa. Good to see you again. It's been 3 years, I think, since we had you and talked about coral.
Yes, thank you very much.
Yes, I've been getting an education on coral. Not good news either. But okay, Brian, so when you were with us at about a year and a half ago, the second general management plan environmental impact statement were in their supplemental draft form. And the final plan was just released now on June 5th. So what was the purpose of all this?
Well, we're trying to redefine how the park is managed. Basically, we're improving the conditions. We hope to improve the conditions of the coral reef by implementing a management reserve zone. And we're updating the current plan from what was previously in place since 1983. So it's been a long time. We're a little overdue. And we're confirming how we are currently managing the plan in policy by defining it and a final general management plan. So 90% of the park is going to stay managed as it currently is, but now we've defined how we're doing it.
Now, there are a lot of stakeholders in a national park, especially Biscayne National Park, but why did it take 14 years to put this together? Mm.
And why is it so huge? I mean, this is a tome here that we have. It's two parts,
yes.
And there are these two books, Elsa? Okay, all right.
Yeah, a general management plan for a park is a complex thing. Joe's absolutely correct. We've got a lot of stakeholders, a lot of varying interests. And we went through and did a tremendous amount of public engagement on this. We had over 22 public meetings, over 1,000 people in attendance, over 43,000 comments, and some adjustments along the way that took quite a while to get it nailed down. But I think we've got a really good plan defined at this point. And Bonnie mentions it's about an 800-page document in total.
What about resistance or opposition to the plan? Did you encounter much of that?
We did along the way. We're a marine park. They're not completely understood by everybody. You know, the surface of the water is really just the beginning for Biscayne National Park. Many of its gems are under the water, the coral reefs, the fishery resources, the seagrass beds. That's all below the surface. And for us land dwellers, that's a little hard to understand from time to time. So the park is about preserving marine resources, and it's taken us a long time to get to the point where we can readily define that and for people to appreciate what's under the water. And fishing is, always has been, always will be a big part of Biscayne National Park, and this plan changes some of the fishing practices, and that's been really difficult to get across with some of the constituents, some of the groups.
By how much, and also, as you've stated, it will probably benefit the overall fishing mm-hmm. in the region. Tell us how that works.
Yeah, we really expect that to happen. We're going to have a marine reserve zone within the park now. It's 10,502 acres. And that'll protect a portion of the coral reef. And we feel without the fishing pressure in there that that will give the corals a chance to recover, the fish a chance to recover, and hopefully result in a spillover effect. So those larger fish that will come to be within that marine reserve zone will start expanding outside of that. And that's where the recreational fishermen will have an opportunity to catch some of them, hopefully in the near future.
Well, let's bring you into this, Elsa. We haven't heard from you yet. First of all, as Chief of Resource Management, you manage the natural and cultural resource programs and planning. Explain what you do, actually.
We have several programs in the park, including a cultural resource management that looks at the archaeological sites, including the submerged sites such as shipwrecks and historic structures such as the Fowey Lighthouse. And the historic structures on Boca Chica. We also have programs that monitor fish and wildlife and vegetation. That's a very big program. We've been struggling with the issue of lionfish. We currently have a couple of interns that their whole entire job is to go out there
and spear them.
Yep, remove the lionfish, and also it contributes to their master's degree studies. So we're doing a lot of science while performing this removal of this very dangerous fish to our reefs.
How did it get so pervasive, the lionfish? What happened?
They have almost no predators. They're from the Indo-Pacific region, and they're almost like your perfect invasive species because they grow very quickly. They have no natural predators in this area, so they're not kept in check, whereas they would, you know, over in the Coral Triangle in the Indo-Pacific region. And they can also reproduce at this tremendously high rate. They don't even have to be all that big to start reproducing. So it's on top of the overfishing, on top of the increased water temperatures from global warming, our reefs are also facing this pressure from lionfish. We also, in our program, we monitor water quality. We've got over 40 water quality monitoring stations in the bay. We measure salinity. As you know, we have a reduced amount of fresh water coming into the bay. And we also have a very vigorous habitat restoration program. We get a lot of boaters in the park, and unfortunately, some of the boaters ground their vessels on the seagrass and on the coral reef. And so we have a program where we assess the damage and then work with the responsible party to come to settlement so we can fund the restoration and monitoring of those areas. So there's a lot of slams on the park's
on the
natural
coral
resources
reefs.
And also, you know, on the cultural resources as well. They also suffer from vessel groundings, and global warming is an issue for those as well.
Also, give us a primer on coral.
Sure.
What it is and how it grows and what it needs.
Sure. There are several species of coral. We currently have 7 species that are on the endangered species list. They're alive. They're a living species, and they're a community, and they're a symbiotic organism. And so you have your zooanthellae and your algae, and when it gets too hot, such as, you know, what we experienced last year was a bleaching event. And they expel their algae, and when they're stressed, they expel it. And when they're stressed for too long due to thermal or even cold, which is rarer, but it happens, and the algae doesn't recolonize the algae, then they're very vulnerable to diseases or death. And we actually had the nicest stand of elkhorn coral in the Florida Keys, within the park, and I witnessed it spawning in 2013, and then in 2014 we had a coral bleaching event, and that stand of Acropora of elkhorn coral died. 96% of the tissue is dead.
Superintendent Carlstrom, tell us more of the highlights of the new management plan.
The plan has many components to it, and we're really hoping to enhance boater safety through this as well, and hopefully minimize some of the groundings that are occurring and further protection of the seagrass beds. We're going to have some no motorized zones, non-combustion engine use zones along the featherbed banks, where we have a lot of groundings. That's an area in the middle of the bay that's on either side of the intercoastal waterway, and we hope by designating that those areas as non-combustion engine use that will help to minimize.
So that's
the
canoes, kayaks, right. And such.
Canoes, kayaks, pole troll fishing can take place there. Electric motors can go through there, and also the area around Jones Lagoon, which is a really important nursery habitat. It's very shallow with a lot of seagrass beds in it for many of the marine species that then go on out and mature on the reefs. Along the shoreline, we're going to have a 1,000-foot slow speed zone that conforms with the county's manatee protection zone as well. We've worked really closely with the county, with Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, to have many of the same zone definitions on the water as what the state already has to make it easier for the boaters to understand. And in the really popular area near Sands Cut, where people like to go out, anchor, swim around their boats, that's going to be an idle speed zone. So it's going to be the slowest speeds possible. So it reduces the potential for conflicts between boaters and swimmers. We want to keep people that are using the park as safe as possible. And that area is currently designated as such, but it's going to be increased in size twofold.
How do you enforce all this?
We have a law enforcement protection group. We have law enforcement rangers. We work very closely with FWC and the county. To
FWC.
Fish and Wildlife.
Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission.
To use our acronyms there.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry. So the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, game wardens and police officers assist us on the water all the time. And we also work very closely with Miami-Dade County. So that's how we do the enforcement within the park.
Elsa, you mentioned something, and I didn't want to let it get by. You said because of the reduced fresh water supply that's coming into the park. Will you explain why that is?
Sure. Biscayne Bay used to be is part of the greater Everglades ecosystem. And before people developed and built the canals, built the levees, and built up a whole bunch of homes in the area, water kind of naturally flowed through creeks and especially through groundwater into Biscayne Bay. And so there are even historical records of the old sailors dipping buckets overboard so that they could get fresh water
from
to
springs.
Drink from the springs in okay. Biscayne Bay. And so, of course, now that's not the situation anymore. It's saline, and sometimes it's even hypersaline. So hypersaline conditions are not good for fish. A lot of the commercially important reef fish, like snappers and groupers, spend their formative time along the mangrove coastline, and their physiology cannot handle very high salinities. Also, when it's more towards fresh, more estuarine conditions, that keeps out some of the marine predators, the fish that would come in and eat these developing fish. So it's a double whammy on the fishes when we get these high saline conditions.
And what causes the high saline?
The water management practices.
Because of having built the canals?
Canals,
and
dam structures, okay. That sort of thing. So a big part of our superintendent's time is actually spent going to water management meetings and doing everything he can to bring increased water deliveries to the park. Increased water deliveries, as long as it's clean and delivered in a timely way, you know, it's all about quantity and delivery and timing. It'll really serve to help restore this important part of the greater Everglades ecosystem. You tend to think of Everglades as being further out west,
but
it's also right here in our bay.
Brian Carlstrom, how well are we handling stormwater runoff into the bay, especially at the Biscayne National Park area?
That's a very good question, Joe, and we work very closely with the South Florida Water Management District on that directly. They control the water that flows into the park, and the stormwater runoff goes into the canals, it's contained in the canals, and then at peak flow, it flushes in. We end up with pulses of fresh water that come in from the stormwater events, and that creates problems in the bay as well. But water quality within the bay is an issue that the park doesn't have any regulatory authority over. The South Florida Water Management District does, the county does, state DEP does, and we work to influence them, to talk with them, and help them realize that the ecology of the bay and the health of those nursery areas along the mangrove shoreline is absolutely critical to the water quality. You have it as high as possible for the salinity to be in as good a condition as it possibly can, and we've had some success. The Water Management District, we have a water conservation allotment during the summertime that helps to keep those conditions as good as possible. They'll release fresh water into the bay when certain conditions are met that really help us out.
About a jewel of our area, which is Biscayne National Park, with the superintendent, Brian Carlstrom, and the chief of resource management of Biscayne National Park is Elsa Alvier. And if you want to join in the conversation, the number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or email is radio@WLRN.org.
And before we take some calls, I have one more question, Superintendent. The park was founded in 1968. How has human use changed in those many years and affected the park?
Well, Joe, the access into the park has been greatly enhanced by advances in technology, specifically for the motorboats. You know, the average horsepower in the motorboats has gone up. The aids to navigation have greatly increased. The number of boat owners in South Florida has gone up. So the human interaction has gone up. More people are enjoying the park and with a lot better tools to do so. But that creates a lot of other stresses on the resource. You know, with the fish finding technology that's out there right now, if you know how to use that equipment, you can find fish just about any day. You know, you can get to areas a lot quicker with the better boats that are available now. And it's really changed how people can experience the park. They can get to areas that would have taken half a day. They can get there in a matter of an hour or an hour and a half. You know, it's really increased the accessibility within the park.
And just one other thing, Elsa, you mentioned before the show that it's very unusual to have bleaching event this early in June for the coral.
Yes, we would normally not expect to see that until later this summer. And unfortunately, in June, we started seeing signs already about coral bleaching. So we're very concerned about that.
And you think that's from the temperature of the water?
Yeah,
high temperature.
Yes, climate change contributing to sea surface temperatures and a lot of the corals in the park are shallow.
And we'll take a call or two. Lloyd in Weston. Hey there.
Hi. I've been diving in and around South Florida since the middle 80s. And, you know, the change in that time, the only word I can use is devastation. But the animals just are not there anymore. The corals have been destroyed. And my question is, how is the general management plan or whatever it is you're going to be doing, how is that going to affect diving in the area? And how do we think things might improve or get better?
I'd be happy to take that. Thank you, Lloyd. The general management plan includes a marine reserve zone. That's going to exclude fishing activities within 10,502 acres.
What percentage of the park's area?
That's really just about 6% of the park, but it's 30% of the park reef. So a significant area of the reef is going to be relieved of that fishing pressure. We're going to go in and do
The divers want to be, of course.
Right. That's where the divers want to be going, is into that marine reserve zone. They'll still be allowed in there. We're going to increase the mooring balls that are available within that area. There's also 5 maritime heritage trail features within that. They're shipwrecks that are identified in the park. We've got over 100 shipwrecks within the park, and we've got 6 of them that are part of a maritime heritage trail. And if you haven't dove on any of those already, Lloyd, I'd encourage you to do so. That's a really great way you can experience the park and experience some of the maritime heritage. And 5 of those 6 features are within that marine reserve zone. So we hope over time, with the relief of the fishing pressure, that the area will be a better place for divers and snorkelers to enjoy, and most importantly for the coral and the coral reef ecosystem to recover from where it is today.
How big is the park?
173,000 acres, and it stretches basically from the Fowleyville Rocks Lighthouse all the way down to Pacific Reef and beyond.
So it's just south of Key Biscayne to just north of Key Largo, right. 22 miles long, 14 miles wide.
Okay.
And we move along to David in Coral Gables. Hi there. David.
Yes, this is David.
Hi, go ahead, David.
I just you were talking about manatees a few minutes ago. My entire life, I've always heard that these manatees were brought here. They're from the West Indies, and as such, doesn't that make them invasive species? And why are we protecting them so much when they actually do a lot of damage to the seagrass, wiping out? Just wipe its ordinary, eat it all, and leave. They don't leave until they've ate it all. So if they're not from here, why are we so walking on tiptoes about these manatees?
Elsa?
So the official species name is the West Indian manatee, but it's also known as the Florida manatee. It is indeed a native species to Florida, and it is part of the ecosystem. It does indeed graze on seagrasses, as do their native sea turtles. In a balanced ecosystem, you have your checks and balances, and so you would, if you have certain species of plants, vegetation, you would expect there to be certain species of herbivores, and we do in fact have a reduced number of manatees from what the system should have, and they've been on the endangered species list for a while because of that. They're not an exotic species.
Or invasive.
No, they're not invasive.
Okay.
They don't have the reproductive capacity to really truly be invasive. They're very slow to reproduce.
Okay, we hope that answers your question, David. We have an emailer, Justin. I want to commend the Biscayne National Park Service and all the hardworking people at the FWC for the work they're doing to protect our most precious resource. I've seen a dramatic increase in the staghorn coral in Broward County as a result of the warming seas increasing the northern range of these corals. Recently, I saw my first elkhorn coral just south of Port Everglades. Has the dredging at Port Miami had a negative effect on the corals in the north end of the park? I'm concerned with the forthcoming dredging of Port Everglades. Elsa?
So we haven't really seen any effects from the port dredging within the park. However, we are aware that there have been some pretty negative impacts to the corals in that area. In case anybody's wondering, how does dredging impact corals? To the corals in the vicinity where you're dredging, of course, means digging. You are removing those corals. But when you do anything underwater, you increase sedimentation. And when that sediment settles on the other benthic organisms like corals and like seagrasses, it can cause a smothering effect.
Mm.
So even though we haven't seen it there, we are aware of the adverse effects of dredging.
Now, has this 14-year process to make this management plan, is it over now? Is it finalized?
Yeah, the plan is in its final form, and now it's going to be time to implement it.
And how do you do that, and what is that going to require?
That is going to require describing how we have the zones defined is how we're going to start managing the park. And much of the park, that's the way we're currently managing it. We have nature observation zones that are difficult to get to. These are the least accessible areas of the mangrove shorelines. These are islands that don't have any visitor facilities on them. They're nature zones. That's how they're currently managed today. We've got visitor use areas both on the park and on Elliott Key that have a lot of, that's where all the visitor infrastructure is. That's where Convoy Point Visitor Center is. That's where the Elliott Key Harbor is. That's where the Boca Chica Harbor is. That's where the Adams Key day use facility is. That's how we manage it today. It's never been defined in policy as a management strategy, but now it is. The new things are going to be the coastal protection area 1,000 feet out, increase of the idle speed zone around Elliott Key, the non-combustion engine use zones on the Featherbed Banks and Jones Lagoon, and the Marine Reserve Zone, and a reduction in size of the Lagar Anchorage, which we really haven't talked about yet. But those changes we're going to start putting in through policy changes that we'll define within a tool that I have within my authority called the Superintendent's Compendium, where we'll define what those are going to be and how that's going to work and how we're going to enforce it. And we'll start putting buoys and navigation indicators out there and working with NOAA to get these features on the water within the navigational aids that they've got.
And when are we talking about?
You got to keep in mind, it took 14 years to develop the plan.
Yeah, I was hoping not going to take 14 years to implement.
We're going to start implementing it as soon as we can.
Okay.
We've already got some things that are starting to happen towards that end. A lot of it, we have been managing it this way, but now it's defined as a way that we will continue to go and try to enhance.
It's kind of understandable that avid fisher people would be a little bit dismayed that there's a shrinkage of the fishing area. However, it is a national park. You wouldn't expect to go hunting in Yellowstone or Sequoia or something like that.
That's correct. You know, the fishing regulations within Biscayne National Park are consistent with the rest of the state. The only regulation that's specific to the park, and this it goes beyond the park, is the lobster sanctuary within the bay itself. The Marine Reserve Zone is the first time within the park that we'll be managing fishing in a definitive way, just to the park, defined by the park.
Which is going to be good for the fish and the coral reefs and ultimately everybody who uses the park.
That's right, Bonnie. That's our hope and expectation.
Especially to the people who, you know, they say, oh, I live in a different part of the country. We don't have coral reefs. Here's a national park that's marine underwater. They have coral reefs. Let me go see it. Well, up until now, they've only been able to see very few fish and not too many fish. And the ones that they see are small because as soon as they reach legal size, they're fished out.
Right.
So they'll have finally one area of the park where they can go to that we hope it'll be spectacular. We hope it'll become a tourist draw.
Well, we want to thank you, Elsa Alveyer. sorry about that.
It's okay.
She's the Chief of Resource Management of Biscayne National Park, managing the natural and cultural resource programs and planning. And Brian Carlstrom has held the office of Superintendent of Biscayne National Park for 3 years and is a recipient of several awards for working with the area agencies and organizations. So we thank you both and congratulations
Good
on
luck.
The final plan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie. Thank you, Joe.
Food and Dining is next.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. I'm Bonnie Berman.
Let's go diving today.
Well, let's wait till the reefs restore.
Okay.
And get restored. Bonnie Berman, Joseph Cooper, and our Thursday Food and Dining special has arrived. Chef, author, and syndicated columnist, and our friend Linda Gassenheimer is with us now. Hello, Linda.
Hello, Bonnie. And our friend just comes first, okay?
our friend comes first, yes. And then everything else. Well, today, of course, we'll learn much more about a special program aimed at decreasing childhood hunger. Certainly a very dismal occurrence that happens more frequently than imagined,
right,
or than that we would like.
You know, Bonnie, it's amazing and a disturbing fact. I didn't even realize this. Over 16 million children in the U.S. struggle with hunger. It's startling that in today's world that this mm-hmm. is the case. So Share Our Strength, No Kid Hungry raises funds to help alleviate this problem, and their Taste of the Nation benefit is going to be held next Thursday, that's July 16th. And our guest, celebrity chef Alan Susser, is with us. He's been in charge of this Taste of the Nation for, hello,
ever.
Alan, is it 27 years?
Yes, it has been, exactly.
Wow, amazing. Well, welcome, Chef Alan Susser. And also with us is Chef Adrienne Calvo. She will be participating in the event, and she has a new book out, or her latest book anyway, is Maximum Flavor Social. Welcome, Chef Adrienne.
Hi, I couldn't be more excited to be here and once again working alongside Chef Alan. I'm a huge fan of his, and what he stands behind, I'm right behind him.
Well, it's a good person to stand behind. And we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any questions for Chef Alan or Chef Calvo? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
And yes, we have email, radio@WLRN.org, radio@WLRN.org.
And of course, with us is our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. Fred gives the wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes columns. And you can read Fred's wine column in Saturday's Miami Herald. Fred, what are we drinking today?
Well, I'm going to talk about what wine to drink for Bastille Day. We have to celebrate Bastille Day.
Okay, next Tuesday, right?
That's right.
Okay, all right. Okay, Chef Alan, tell us a little bit about Taste of the Nation and the funds that they raise here for this event. Is they going to stay here in Florida?
Of course, yes. Taste of the Nation is a great event. It's 50 chefs, and each of them is donating their time, their energy, and their creativity to raise money for Childhood Hungry. No Kid Hungry is the campaign, and 100% of the ticket price goes to fight hunger, and it does stay here in Florida and in South Florida specifically.
Well, that's fantastic. And it's going to be at the Los Hotel. I mean, you're going to have 50 chefs coming into the Los Hotel next Thursday. That's a huge thing to sort of organize. I mean, imagine all these chefs.
It's really one of the best days in a chef's life, because we get together and we work together and we use our creative energies for the good of the community. And also we get out of our own kitchens and get to share our culinary expertise and fun and excitement with other peers, other chefs. So it's really the spot that the chefs get to kind of show off a little bit for each other and cook for each other. And one of the fun things is that so many of the chefs just kind of go around and make sure that your chef friend eats your cooking, and then we get to cook for our guests and our friends that come. So it's really a great chef's party to fight hunger.
Well,
Chef Allen, how does the money actually turn into food that gets to the kids in South Florida through No Kid Hungry?
Well, it's focused on kids and childhood hunger, and a majority of the dollars actually goes to the kids through a breakfast in the classroom project. So what happens is that they breakfast in the classroom, the first period of class, and we're out for summer, so it actually takes on a different role during summer. But during the rest of the year, within first period, the kids get a hot meal. And so this not only is a hot meal, but it also gives them the ability and the want to get to school on time. It gives them the food to get them going in the morning. It, in general, gives them more healthy nutritional environment that they're eating in, and they're less sick, as well as not only that, they're prepared to learn. Prepared to learn, that's kind of where the hunger issue with kids is all about.
Okay. So, Chef Adrian, you're going to be bringing something there? You're going to be tasting? What are you going to be doing at the Taste of the Nation?
Well, I'm going to be serving our sweet corn tamalito with some crispy chorizo and some lime beurre blanc. It's actually one of our greatest sellers at Chef Adrian's. The recipe is in my cookbook, so I can't wait to share it with everyone. It's going to be a fantastic night, and I can't wait to see people's expressions. My favorite part of doing Taste of the Nation, No Kid Hungry, is the type of people that go there are already foodies. So when they stop by your booth and, you know, they get to meet the chef and they taste your food, their reaction, it's insane. It's gratifying, and to know that you're doing it for a great cause, it's all the more rewarding.
That sounds wonderful and terrific. Well, Chef Allen, I want to thank you for taking just a few minutes to join us today. I know how busy you are. You've got to get over to the Lowe's Hotel and start getting this whole thing underway for next week. So thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Hope to see everybody there next week on Thursday night. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Allen.
Thanks.
Okay, have a great day.
See you next week. Right.
Okay, see you then.
All right, and so... Bye-bye. Chef Calvo, you're going to be participating in all, and you mentioned your book, and we've been talking about Taste of the Nation, but your book is called, talking about taste, Maximum Flavor, Maximum Flavor Social. So that's an amazing title there. What did you mean by it?
Well, Maximum Flavor Social, my first cookbook written in 2003 was called Maximum Flavor, and since then, everyone, not just the culinary industry, but everyone has witnessed, everything turning into social media. Whatever age you are, it doesn't matter if you're a preteen or if you're, you know, elderly. People are using Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, not just for businesses, but to stay in contact with their families. They share vacation pictures. But the number one thing that's on social media is food. And it doesn't have to be a chef dish. It could be the snack that you're obsessing over for the last week or so. It doesn't have to be a whole entire fancy thing. It could be, you know, your post-workout meal. But food is the number one thing on social media.
So how do you, so your book is about social media or is about food? Or
it is about.
How is it connected?
It is about social food in social media, but the fact that it's not just social media. Food is a social event in general, whether you're eating with one other person, whether you're eating in a large group or an event like Taste of the Nation, or whether you are by yourself, but now you're sharing it with others, so you're technically not by yourself anymore.
Okay, so do you connect with your people who come to the restaurant? And so what kind of responses do you get in that respect?
Well, that's what got me addicted and into writing Maximum Flavor Social. When I opened Chef Adrian's over 8 years ago, it wasn't so eminent, the social media presence in the food industry. People still read the newspaper on Thursdays and Sundays to find out about chefs and new restaurants. Now it's immediate. You walk into a restaurant and you see people are taking out their phones and taking pictures by your sign of the entrance. They're taking pictures of a glass of wine. They're taking pictures of the menu and whatnot.
So you don't mind people taking pictures in the restaurant?
I don't. I actually...
Some do sometimes.
Yeah, no, yeah. My dining time at Chef Adrian's is 2.5 to 3 hours per table. I'd rather people enjoy their time. I'm not in a hurry. I'm not in a hurry to turn over seats.
So you don't turn over the table to get...
I do, but, I mean, thankfully it's worked out so far. I mean, we're really in it for the love of the game.
It might make some couples a little nervous with people pulling out cameras.
Yes. We don't want to go in that direction.
No, Joe. They're the ones pulling them out.
He's opening up a can of worms.
Yeah. Yeah. Chef Adrian, where is your restaurant?
We are in South Kendall. We are actually on 11510 Southwest 147th Avenue, close to Homestead, pretty much.
Mm. So it's out west.
Yeah, it's out
west in Kendall.
So yeah, in the book, what we did was collect all of the our greatest hits on social media, and we shared the recipes.
So have you ever gotten some disturbing comments?
Not so far. I mean, I've gotten marriage proposals. I've gotten, can we take you home? I've gotten funny things. I haven't gotten anything bad.
Can I ask what you brought in?
Oh, what I brought in is the all-time dish that's gotten, thousands of comments throughout time. A couple years ago, I came up with...
I didn't want to make noise opening it.
Now you
got to make it. Yes. It doesn't look like much, by the way, but it's a dark chocolate and Nutella croissant bread pudding. And people cannot get enough of it at Chef Adrian's. And it's funny because it came from an actual experience where I had never tasted Nutella until I was 25 years old.
I'm going to give some to
tell some people what Nutella is. Some people may not know.
Wow. Oh, it's a hazelnut, chocolate and hazelnut spread from Italy. And so I had never tasted it. And people were like, are you crazy? You've never had it? I'm like, no. And once I tasted it, I'm like, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to make a bread pudding. And I mean, wow.
It's
Bonnie's
so rich.
Face. It's incredible.
It's so rich. I could eat the whole thing.
Well, I don't know about the whole thing, but it is so good.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. No wonder. Skip the dinner.
Well, I mean, the recipe, it's in the book, and that's exactly what I love. I love seeing people's reaction to food. I love that they share it on social media, and I feel like food it's about sharing, and I think in the last 10, 15 years, it turned from sharing just, now it's sharing on 3D. You know, now we're sharing our general experience with the world.
Right, so that's, Fred, was that you?
Fred. No, it wasn't me.
Okay. Oh.
So in the book, it's not just talking about the social media and all. You have some recipes there.
It's all full of recipes. The book is written in first person, so it's actually my journey as I become a chef. It talks about the evolution of how I lived personally, the transition from no social media to how social media is almost more important than word of mouth nowadays. I mean, people read their phones or read Twitter recommendations or whatnot easier than they take an opinion from somebody. And it's almost sad.
Oh, definitely. Well,
but it's wonderful. Reality. But, you know, on the positive note, whatever you're, you know, if you're sending out a message of positivity and great, you know, it's good.
Yeah, great. All right. We have to go to a break. We'll take a short break here. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we were talking with Chef Alan Susser. He's been told us all about the Taste of the Nation Share Our Strengths event for No Kid Hungry. And now we're talking with Chef Adrian Calvo. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. And we were talking with Chef Alan Susser. He was telling us all about the Taste of the Nation Share Our Strengths No Kid Hungry event that's going to be taking place next Thursday, July 16th at the Lowe's Hotel. And it's really an important event. And they also have an after party as well. So, and they're going to be having, on top of that, a beer garden this year. And Evan Benn, food editor for the Miami Herald, is going to be one of the co-hosts of that. So lots going on at the Lowe's Hotel next Thursday. Well, it's And also, sorry, with us is Chef Adrienne Calvo. I got so excited about the beer garden. and she's going to be partaking in it. And her latest book is Maximum Flavor Social. She's been telling us all about that. Well, so I've got some maximum flavor for you here. It's called Dinner in Minutes. And my dinner, we alluded to this earlier. Fred Tasker talked about Bastille Day. That's July 14th. And it's going to be next Tuesday. So today's dinner in a minute is a French salad niçoise. Very simple. It's a favorite on the French Riviera. You can see it up and down the Riviera if you're lucky enough to be sitting on a quay there and enjoying the sun and water. It has tuna, it has green beans, olives, and tomatoes. And in fact, you could use any leftover vegetables, but choose ones for color and texture to make the dish look really pretty. Now, first of all, I blanch the green beans. So that means you just throw them into some boiling water. As soon as the water comes back to the boil, you take them out and refresh them in cold water. But if you didn't want to do that, just stick them in the microwave for a minute just to get them a little bit soft. And then for the tuna. Well, you want really rare tuna for this. So you just get a skillet really, really hot and maybe 2 minutes aside for the tuna and then take it off the heat and let it rest for a minute. It'll be very rare. If you want it a little more medium rare, leave it in that skillet for a couple more minutes.
No chicken of the sea?
This is the real stuff here. Okay. You could if you wanted. but you don't have to bother cooking it, okay? I just want you to know that, Joe.
Yes. That's so, good point, Linda.
Yeah, we have to keep Joe straight here. All right, so to finish the salad, you put some lettuce on a platter, and then you put the green beans. You arrange these in an attractive way. And here I have to make... I'm admitting something in Dinner in Minutes. I use for this canned little baby potatoes. They're quite good, and if you have a good salad dressing, it just would be just fine if you're in a hurry. And then to cut the tuna into strips, put that on, some tomato wedges, some olives, and a very good quality olive oil, olive and vinegar dressing to spoon over the top. Now, we talked, if you remember, a couple of weeks ago about making your own vinaigrette, which really is so simple and easy, and it doesn't have any chemicals, and I've given that recipe as well. So either way, either bottled or you're making
your own.
What's
that ratio again?
You're going to think I have to remember this out of my head, right? That you're testing me?
Well, it's pretty simple. Isn't
it? It's right. Well, let's say 2 tablespoons of vinegar. Let's say a red wine vinegar. I like to use a sherry wine vinegar. You could use balsamic vinegar. You could use 2 tablespoons
of
lemon
juice. I like using champagne, orange champagne vinegar.
Bonnie, I'm impressed.
Yes.
That sounds delicious.
It is, and Fred would like it too.
I think you should just drink it rather than putting it on.
So anyway, and then 2 teaspoons, but rounded teaspoons of Dijon mustard. And the point is that you mix that all together really, really well, so it's well combined. And then, let me see, so 2 and 3.
So you just put
6
that in a little jar and shake it?
Sure. And then, or in the food processor, whatever.
What about salt?
Well, be careful with the salt. You can add it, but add it afterwards because mustard has a lot of salt in it. So you don't want it to be too much salty.
Mustard, yeah.
And then 6 tablespoons of oil, canola oil. If you use olive oil,
so it's 1 to 3.
Yeah. Make it in, thank you for doing the math, Joe.
You're real genius here.
Anyway, that recipe, the whole recipe, including the vinaigrette dressing, is a photograph is at dinnerinminutes.com. And please join me on Twitter. That's @ElGassenheimer. We're talking about social media today, @ElGassenheimer. Fred Tasker, what are we drinking?
Well, as we have determined, the French holiday called Bastille Day is coming next Tuesday, July 14. And for the French, this is like our 4th of July. It's the date of the beginning of the French Revolution on the 14th of July in 1789. When peasants stormed the Paris prison called the Bastille. So for Americans, it's just a good excuse to drink good French wine when there's nothing wrong with that. So here's my suggestion.
And Adrienne's sitting here nodding her head. That's okay, right, Adrienne?
Absolutely. So my suggestion is Beaujolais. Now, to most Americans, Beaujolais means Beaujolais Nouveau or New Beaujolais. This is the first wine that's made from each year's harvest, and the grapes are picked in September, and the wine is released just 2 months later on the third Thursday in November. In fact, producers race to get their wines to shops and restaurants first, and we throw big parties when it arrives in Miami. Now, to do this, of course, they have to make the wines very quickly. So they soak the juice on the grape skins for a very short time, ferment it quickly, and age it for just weeks before releasing it. So this is a Beaujolais Nouveau that results is very fruity and delicious, but also very simple. Most of it is $15 or less, and it has almost no aging potential. In fact, much of it is drunk by Christmas and nearly all within a single year. And there's nothing wrong with that either. But what a lot of people don't understand is that Beaujolais also makes other wines that they're called, they don't really have a name. They're called Real Beaujolais or Serious Beaujolais. And these are made much like regular wines with longer skin soaking, longer fermentation, and even a year or two of aging. Now, Serious Beaujolais wines are really much better than the Nouveau. In addition to the lush fruit of the Beaujolais Nouveau, they can have much more complex aromas and flavors, even herbs, smoke, minerals, and such. And even then, they're mostly less than $25.
Are you talking about a good Beaujolais less than $25?
You can get it, yeah, that's right.
Whoa, I would have thought more.
The best of these wine come from one of 10 villages in the Beaujolais region that are designated crus, that's C-R-U-S, or classified growths. These include villages and wines called Fleury, Juliana, Moulin Avant, and that sort of thing. And the main way that you can tell that they are that way is that they have the village names on the bottle and they don't say Nouveau. If it doesn't say Nouveau, then it's one of these. These are serious wines capable of 5 or 10 years of aging, and they're still very light-bodied, so they would go well with powerful fish like salmon or tuna. In fact, they go nicely with Linda's Salade Niçoise, I think.
You think a red wine with that? Well, oh, okay, I guess with tuna.
Yeah, a light-bodied
wine. But it's not too heavy?
Like
it wouldn't be too heavy for it?
I don't think so.
Okay, all right.
Or it would also go well with turkey dishes or semi-soft French cheeses, so... When next Tuesday comes, march down to your local wine shop and shout Vive la Liberté and give me a bottle of Real Serious Beaujolais.
All right, Fred, we'll do that. Thank you very much. Let's go back to Chef Adrian. Chef Adrian, your book is called Maximum Flavor. We talked about the social. Maximum Flavor is social. But we talked about the social part. If we want to get some maximum flavor in our own dishes at home, give us a hint. Give us some suggestions.
Well, the whole idea of maximum flavor, it's a way of cooking where you activate all parts of your palate. So it sends a message to your brain like it's a roller coaster of flavors. While you are keeping, it's not crazy. What it is that you're getting that sweet, sour, salty, bitter, spicy, everything in there, subtle, but everything is in there. So all of a sudden your brain has this message of happy. Oh my gosh, I'm interested. And that's what maximum flavor is.
Well, but I find so many people use hot spices and so much hot spice that you can't get any flavor at all.
That is not at all how my cooking is.
So give us some examples.
Well, for example, we have a brown sugar crusted salmon that we do, which is, it's also been one of our greatest hits. That recipe is also in Maximum Flavor Social, where we'll crust the salmon fillet with brown sugar, sprinkle it with a little bit of chef's dust, which is about to come out.
Chef's dust?
Yeah, that's my product line that's about to launch. It's a spice blend where it has garlic salt, a little bit of pepper, and a couple of secret ingredients that I can't disclose yet. But you put that spice blend, not spicy, but it is a spice blend, over that brown sugar crust, and it makes for an amazing texture and flavor. And that's how
you cook it. Do you cook?
We sear it first to make that crust. It melts down that brown sugar a little bit.
It doesn't burn.
Does not burn. Nope. I mean, if you burn it, that's on you. But
okay. All right.
And what was the name of this dessert again, Chef
Dark
Adrian?
Chocolate Nutella croissant bread pudding.
All right, Bonnie, you're going to save some for me.
Yes, well, thank of course. You.
Right.
Linda.
All right, we'll see. Okay, so it's been a really tasty week. It's gone by. Chef Adrian Calvo, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And for the, what's the name of the dessert again?
Dark chocolate Nutella croissant bread dessert.
Okay.
How is that?
Well, I love how you said croissant.
Croissant.
Yes. Croissant. Well, she's got this French nature in her.
Yes.
Okay. Her book is Maximum Flavor Social. And her restaurant is Chef Adrian's Vineyard and Restaurant Bar. And tell us where it is.
11510 Southwest 147th Avenue.
And I bet you have a website.
ChefAdrians.com.
All right. Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Happy July 14th.
Yeah, same to you.
Joe Cooper, Bonnie Bernman, nice to be with you today.
Likewise.
Thank you.
Okay, next I'll be bringing in my favorite finds from the Fancy Food Show. It's a preview of next year's eating trends. So get your palates ready, you guys. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And thanks for tuning in. Our Topical Currents lead producer is Richard Ives. Additional programming from Polly Landis. Our longtime technical director is producer Paul Leary, who also composes our online presentations. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information, links, and also at the Topical Currents Facebook page.
Something like that.
Tell us about Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat tomorrow, quickly.
Well, Ed hosts another live performance from our studios with Sammy Figueroa, presenting a tribute to the music of Cal Jader.
Oh, yeah, long time. Monday, Bonnie and I return with a program which explains the difficulties of postpartum depression with filmmaker Maureen Fura. Thanks for listening. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Linda Gassenheimer, Fred Tasker. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.